Chapter 10 Barbara Captured by Headhunters. When Barbara Harding, with Miller before and Swenson behind her, had taken up the march behind the loot-laden party, seven dusky, noiseless shadows had emerged from the forest to follow close behind. For half a mile, the party moved along the narrow trail unmolested. Terrier had come back to exchange a half-dozen words with the girl, and had again moved forward toward the head of the column. Miller was not more than 25 feet behind the first man ahead of him, and Miss Harding and Swenson followed at intervals of but 3 or 4 yards. Suddenly, without warning, Swenson and Miller fell, pierced with savage spears, and at the same instant, sinewy fingers gripped Barbara Harding, and a silencing hand was clapped over her mouth. There had been no sound above the muffled tread of the seamen. It had all been accomplished so quickly and so easily that the girl did not comprehend what had befallen her for several minutes. In the darkness of the forest, she could not clearly distinguish the forms or features of her abductors, though she reasoned, as was only natural, that Skipper Sims' party had become aware of the plot against them and had taken this means of thwarting a part of it. But when her captors turned directly into the mazes of the jungle, away from the coast, she began first to wonder and then to doubt. So that presently, when a small clearing let the moonlight fall upon them, she was not surprised to discover that none of the members of the Half Moon's company was among her guard. Barbara Harding had not circled the globe half a dozen times for nothing. There were few races or nations with whose history, past and present, she was not fairly familiar, and so the sight that greeted her eyes was well suited to fill her with astonishment, for she found herself in the hands of what appeared to be a party of Japanese warriors of the 15th or 16th century. She recognized the medieval arms and armor, the ancient helmets, the hairdressing of the two-sworded men of old Japan. At the belts of two of her captors dangled grisly trophies of the hunt. In the moonlight, she saw that they were the heads of Miller and Swenson. The girl was horrified. She had thought her lot before as bad as it could be, but to be in the clutches of these strange, fierce warriors of a long-dead age was unthinkably worse. That she could ever have wished to be back upon the Half Moon would have seemed, a few days since, incredible. Yet that was precisely what she longed for now. On through the night marched the little brown men, grim and silent, until at last they came to a small village in a valley away from the coast, a valley that lay nestled high among lofty mountains. Here were cave-like dwellings burrowed half underground, the upper walls and thatched roofs rising scarce 4 feet above the level. Granaries on stilts were dotted here and there among the dwellings. Into one of the filthy dens Barbara Harding was dragged. She found a single room in which several native and half-caste women were sleeping. About them stretched and curled and perched a motley throng of dirty yellow children, dogs, pigs, and chickens. It was the palace of Daimyo Oda Yorimoto, Lord of Yoka, as his ancestors had christened their new island home. Once within the warren, the two samurai who had guarded Barbara upon the march turned and withdrew. She was alone with Oda Yorimoto and his family. From the center of the room depended a swinging shelf, upon which a great pile of grinning skulls rested. At the back of the room was a door, which Barbara had not at first noticed. Evidently there was another apartment to the dwelling. The girl was given little opportunity to examine her new prison, for scarce had the guards withdrawn than Oda Yorimoto approached and grasped her by the arm. "Come," he said, in Japanese that was sufficiently similar to modern Nippon to be easily understood by Barbara Harding. With the word, he drew her toward a sleeping mat on a raised platform at one side of the room. One of the women awoke at the sound of the man's voice. She looked up at Barbara with a sullen hatred. Otherwise, she gave no indication that she saw anything unusual transpiring. It was as though an exquisite American belle were a daily visitor at the Oda Yorimoto home.
"What do you want of me?"
cried the frightened girl, in Japanese. Oda Yorimoto looked at her in astonishment. Where had this white girl learned to speak his tongue?
"I am the Daimyo Oda Yorimoto," he said. "These are my wives. Now you are one of them. Come."
"Not yet, not here," cried the girl, clutching at a straw. "Wait, give me time to think. If you do not harm me, my father will reward you fabulously. 10,000 koku he would gladly give to have me return to him safely."
Oda Yorimoto but shook his head.
20,000 koku,
cried the girl. Still, the daimyo shook his head negatively.
100,000. Name your own price if you will, but not harm me.
"Silence," growled the man. "What are even 1,000,000 koku to me, who only know the word from my legends of my ancestors? We have no need for koku here. And had we, my heels are full of the yellow metal, which measures its value. No, you are my woman. Come."
"Not here, not here," pleaded the girl. "There is another room, away from all these women."
And she turned her eyes toward the door at the opposite side of the chamber. Oda Yorimoto shrugged his shoulders. That would be easier than a fight, he argued. And so he led the girl toward the doorway that she had indicated. Within, the room was all dark, but the daimyo moved as one accustomed to the place, and as he moved through the blackness, the girl at his side felt with stealthy fingers at the man's belt. At last, Oda Yorimoto reached the far side of the long chamber.
"Here," he said, and took her by the shoulders.
"Here,"
answered the girl in a low, tense voice, and at the instant that she spoke, Oda Yorimoto, Lord of Yoka, felt a quick tug at his belt, and before he guessed what was to happen, his own short sword had pierced his breast. A single shriek broke from the lips of the daimyo, but it was so high and shrill, like the shriek of a woman in mortal terror, that the woman in the next room who heard it but smiled a crooked, wicked smile of hate, and turned once more upon her pallet to sleep. Again and again, Barbara Harding plunged the sword of the brown man into the still heart, until she knew beyond peradventure of a doubt that her enemy was forevermore powerless to injure her. Then she sank, exhausted and trembling, upon the dirt floor beside the corpse. When Terrierre came to the realization that Barbara Harding was gone, he jumped to the natural conclusion that Ward and Sims had discovered the ruse that he had worked upon them, just in time to permit them to intercept Miller and Swenson with the girl and carry her back to the main camp. The others were prone to agree with him, though the mucker grumbled that it listened fishy. However, all hands returned cautiously down the face of the cliff, expecting momentarily to be attacked by the guards, which they felt sure Ward would post in expectation of a return of the mutineers the moment they discovered that the girl had been taken from them. But to the surprise of all, they reached the cove without molestation, and when they had crept cautiously to the vicinity of the sleepers, they discovered that all were there, in peaceful slumber, just as they had left them a few hours before. Silently, the party retraced its steps up the cliff. Derriere and Billy Byrne brought up the rear.
"What do you make of it, anyway, Byrne?"
asked the Frenchman.
"If you want to get it straight, Cole," replied the mucker, "I think you know a lot more about it than you'd like to have the rest of us think."
"What do you mean, Byrne?" cried Terrier. "Out with it now."
"Sure, I'll out with it. You didn't think I was bashful, did you? What for did you detail them two pikers, Miller and Swenson, to guard the skirt, for if it wasn't for some special frame-up of your own? They never been in our gang. That's just what you wanted them for. It was easy to tip them off to hike out with the squab, and the first chance you'd get, you'll hike after them, like we hold a bag. Thought you'd double-cross us easy, didn't you? You cheapskate."
"Burn," said Terrier,
and it was easy to see that only through the strength of his willpower did he keep his temper.
"You may have cause to suspect the motives of everyone connected with this outfit. I can't say that I blame you, but I want you to remember what I say to you now. There was a time when I fully intended to double-cross you, as you say. That was before you saved my life. Since then, I have been on the square with you, not only in deed, but in thought as well. I give you the word of a man whose word once meant something. I am playing square with you now, except in one thing, and I shall tell you what that is at once. I do not know where Miss Harding is, or what has happened to her, and Miller and Swenson. That is God's truth. Now for the one thing that I just mentioned. Recently, I changed my intentions relative to Miss Harding. I was after the money, the same as the rest. That I am free to admit. But now, I don't give a rap for it, and I had intended taking advantage of the first opportunity to return Miss Harding to civilization unarmed and without the payment of a penny to anyone. The reason for my change of heart is my own affair. In all probability, you wouldn't believe the sincerity or honesty of my motives should I disclose them. I am only telling you these things because you have accused me of double-dealing. And I do not want the man who saved my life at the risk of his own to have the slightest grounds to doubt my honesty with him. I've been a fairly bad egg, Byrne, for a great many years. But, by George, I'm not entirely rotten yet."
Byrne was silent for a few moments. He, too, had recently come to the conclusion that possibly he was not entirely rotten either, and had, in a vague and half-formed sort of way, wished for the opportunity to demonstrate the fact. So he was willing to concede to another that which he craved for himself.
Yeah, listen, all right, Cole," he said at last. "And I'm willing to take you at your own say-so till I learn's different."
"Thanks," said Terrier tersely. "Now we can work together in the search for Miss Harding. But where in the name of all that's holy are we to start?"
"Why, where we seen her last, of course," replied the mucker. "Right here, on top of these bluffs."
"Then we can't do anything until daylight," said the Frenchman.
"Not a thing. And at daylight, we'll most likely have a scrap on our hands from below."
And the mucker jerked his thumb in the direction of the cove.
"I think," said Terrier, "that we had better spend an hour arming ourselves with sticks and stones. We've a mighty good position up here. One that we can defend splendidly from an assault from below. And if we are prepared for them, We can stave him off for a while if we needs a time to search about up here for clues to Miss Harding's whereabouts.
And so the party set to work to cut stout bludgeons from the trees about them and pile loose fragments of rock in handy places near the cliff top. Derriere even went so far as to throw up a low breastwork across the top of the trail, up which the enemy must climb to reach the summit of the cliff. When they had completed their preparations, three men could have held the place against 10 times their own number. Then they lay down to sleep, leaving Blanco and Divine on guard, for it had been decided that these two, with Bony Sawyer, should be left behind on the morrow to hold the cliff top, while the others were searching for clues to the whereabouts of Barbara Harding. They were to relieve each other at guard duty during the balance of the night. Scarce had the first suggestion of dawn lightened the eastern sky than Divine, who was again on guard, awakened Terrier. In a moment the others were aroused, and a hasty raid on the cached provisions made. The lack of water was keenly felt by all, but it was too far to the spring to chance taking the time necessary to fetch the much-craved fluid, and those who were to forge into the jungle in search of Barbara Harding hoped to find water farther inland. While it was decided to dispatch Bony Sawyer to the spring for water for those who were to remain on guard at the cliff top. The hurried breakfast was made on water-soaked ship's biscuit. Terrier and his searching party stuffed their pockets full of them, and a moment later the search was on. First, the men traversed the trail toward the spring, looking for indications of the spot where Barbara Harding had ceased to follow them. The girl had worn heelless buckskin shoes at the time she was taken from the Lotus, and these left little or no spoor in the well-tramped earth of the narrow path. But a careful and minute examination on the part of Terrier finally resulted in the detection of a single small footprint 100 yards from the point they had struck the trail after ascending the cliffs. This far, at least, she had been with them. The men now spread out upon either side of the track, Terrier and Red Sanders upon one side, Burn and Wizen upon the other. Occasionally, Terrier would return to the trail to search for further indications of the spoor they sought. The party had proceeded in this fashion for nearly half a mile, when suddenly they were attracted by a low exclamation from the mucker.
"Here," he called, "here's Miller and Swede. And they sure have mussed them up terrible."
The others hastened in the direction of his voice to come to a horrified halt at the sides of the headless trunks of the two sailors.
"Mon Dieu!"
exclaimed the Frenchman, reverting to his mother tongue, as he never did except under the stress of great excitement.
"Oh, done it?"
queried Red Sanders, looking suspiciously at the mucker.
"Head hunters," said Terrier. "God, what an awful fate for that poor girl."
Billy Byrne went white.
"You don't mean that they've lapped off her block?"
he whispered in an awed voice. Something strange rose in the mucker's breast at the thought he had just voiced. He did not attempt to analyze the sensation, but it was far from joy at the suggestion that the woman he so hated had met a horrible and disgusting death at the hands of savages.
"I'm afraid not, Byrne," said Terrier,
in a voice that none there would have recognized as that of the harsh and masterful second officer of the Half Moon.
"You're afraid not?"
echoed Billy Byrne in amazement.
"For her sake, I hope that they did," said Terrier. "For such as she, it would have been a far less horrible fate than the one I fear they have reserved for her."
"You mean?" queried Byrne, and then he stopped, for the realization of just what Terrier did mean swept over him quite suddenly. There was no particular reason why Billy Byrne should have felt toward women those finer sentiments which are so cherished a possession of those men who have been gently born and raised, even after they have learned that all women are not as was the feminine ideal of their boyhood. Billy's mother, always foul-mouthed and quarrelsome, had been a veritable demon when drunk, and drunk she had been whenever she could, by hook or crook, raise the price of whiskey. Never, to Billy's recollection, had she spoken a word of endearment to him, and so terribly had she abused him that even while he was yet a little boy, scarce out of babyhood, he had learned to view her with a hatred as deep-rooted as is the affection of most little children for their mothers. When he had come to man's estate, he had defended himself from the woman's brutal assaults as he would have defended himself from another man. When she had struck, Billy had struck back. The only thing to his credit being that he never had struck her except in self-defense. Chastity in woman was to him a thing to joke of. He did not believe that it existed, for he judged other women by the one he knew best, his mother. And as he hated her, so he hated them all. He had doubly hated Barbara Harding, since she not only was a woman, but a woman of the class he loathed. And so it was strange and inexplicable that the suggestion of the girl's probable fate should have affected Billy Byrne as it did. He did not stop to reason about it at all. He simply knew that he felt a mad and unreasoning rage against the creatures that had borne the girl away. Outwardly, Billy showed no indication of the turmoil that raged within his breast.
"We gotta find her, Boo," he said to Terrier. "We gotta find the skirt."
Ordinarily, Billy would have blustered about the terrible things he would do to the objects of his wrath when once he had them in his power. But now he was strangely quiet. Only the firm set of his strong chin and the steely glitter of his gray eyes gave token of the iron resolution within. Terrier, who had been walking slowly to and fro about the dead men, now called the others to him.
"Here's their trail," he said. "If it's as plain as that all the way, we won't be long in overhauling them. Come along."
Before he had the words half out of his mouth, the mucker was forging ahead through the jungle, along the well-marked spoor of the samurai.
"What kind of men do you suppose they are?"
asked Red Sanders.
"Malaysian headhunters, unquestionably," replied Terrier.
Red Sanders shuddered inwardly. The appellation had a most gruesome sound.
"Come on," cried Terrier,
and started off after the mucker, who already was out of sight in the thick forest. Red Sanders and Wizen took a few steps after the Frenchman. Terrier turned once to see that they were following him, and then a turn in the trail hid them from his view. Red Sanders stopped.
"Damn me if I'm not going to get my coconut act off by any such wild goose chase as this," he said to Wizen.
"The girl's more'n likely dead long ago," said the other.
"Sure she is," returned Red Sanders. "And if we go a button in at that there thicket, we'll be dead too. Whew, poor Miller. Poor Swenson. It's awful. Just see what they done to him without it's cutting off their heads."
"Yes," whispered Wizen, looking suddenly behind him.
Red Sanders gave a little start, peering in the direction that his companion had looked.
"What is it?" he whimpered. "What you do that for?"
"I thought I seen Thumper move over there," replied Wizen. "For gosh sake, let's get out in this."
And without waiting for a word of assent from his companion, the sailor turned and ran at breakneck speed along the little path toward the spot where Divine, Blanco, and Boney Sawyer were stationed. When they arrived, Boney Sawyer was just on the point of setting out for the spring to fetch water, but at the sight of the frightened, breathless men, he returned to hear their story.
"What's up?"
shouted Divine.
"You men look as though you'd seen a ghost. Where are the others?" "They's all murdered, and their heads cut off," cried Red Sanders. "We found a bunch that got Miller Swenson and the girl. They killed them all, and was eating of them when we jumped them. Before we knew what had happened, about 1,000 more the devils come running up. They got us separated, and when we seen Derriere and Byrne guilt, we just naturally beat it. God, but it was awful."
"You think they will follow you?" asked Divine. At the suggestion, every head turned toward the trail down which the two panic-stricken men had just come. At the same moment, a hoarse shout arose from the cove below, and the five looked down to see a scene of wild activity upon the beach. The defection of Terrier's party had been discovered, as well as the absence of the girl and the theft of the provisions. Skipper Sims was dancing about like a madman. His bellowed oaths rolled up the cliffs like thunder. Presently, Ward caught a glimpse of the men at the top of the cliff above him.
"There they are!"
he cried. Skipper Sims looked up.
"The swabs!" he shrieked. "A stealing of our grub and abducting of that there poor girl! The swabs! Let me to 'em, I say! Just let me to 'em!"
"We'd all better go to 'em," said Ward. "We got a fight on here, sure. Gather up some rocks, men, and come along. Skipper, you're too fat to do any fighting on that there hillside, so you better stay here and let one of the men take your gun."
For Ward knew so well the mettle of his superior that he much preferred his absence to his presence in the face of real fighting, and with the gun in the hands of a braver man, it would be vastly more effective. Ward himself was no lover of a fight, but he saw now that starvation might stare them in the face with their food gone, and everything be lost with the loss of the girl. For food and money, a much more cowardly man than Bender Ward would fight to the death. Up the face of the cliff they hurried, expecting momentarily to be either challenged or fired upon by those above them. Divine and his party looked down with mixed emotions upon those who were ascending in so threatening a manner. They found themselves truly between the devil and the deep sea. Ward and his men were halfway up the cliff, yet Divine had made no move to repel them. He glanced timorously toward the dark forest behind, from which he momentarily expected to see the savage, snarling faces of the headhunters appear.
"Surrender, you swabs!" cried Ward from below, "or we'll string the last mother's son of you to the yardarm!"
For reply, Blanco hurled a heavy fragment of rock at the assaulters. It grazed perilously close to Ward, against whom Blanco cherished a keen hatred. Instantly, Ward's revolver barked, the bullet whistling close by Divine's head. L. Courtright Divine, cotillion leader, ducked behind Terrier's breastwork, where he lay sprawled upon his belly, trembling in terror. Boney Sawyer and Red Sanders followed the example of their commander. Blanco and Wizen alone made any attempt to repel the assault. The big Negro ran to Divine's side and snatched the terror-stricken man's revolver from his belt. Then, turning, he fired at Ward. The bullet, missing its intended victim, pierced the heart of a sailor directly behind him, and as the man crumpled to the ground, rolling down the steep declivity, his fellows sought cover. Wizen followed up the advantage with a shower of well-aimed missiles, and then hostilities ceased temporarily.
"Have they gone?" queried Devine, with trembling lips, noticing the quiet that followed the shot.
"Gone nothing, you big coward," replied Blanco. "You don't suppose that two men is a-gwine to stand off five? If your white-livered skunks would get up a fight, we might have a chance. I's a good mind to cut out your cowardly heart for you. That's what I has, lying down your belly, setting that kind of example for your men."
Divine's terror had placed him beyond the reach of contumely or reproach.
"What's the use of fighting them?" he whimpered. "We should never have left them. It's all the fault of that fool Terrier. What can we do against the savages of this awful island if we divide our forces? They will pick us off a few at a time, just as they picked off Miller and Swenson, Terrier and Byrne. We ought to tell Ward about it and call this foolish battle off."
"Now you're talking," cried Bony Sawyer. "I'm not a-going to squat up here any longer with my friends a-shooting at me and blowing a lot of wild heathen creeping down on me from above to cut off my blooming head."
"Same here," chimed in Red Sanders.
Blanco looked toward Wizen. For his own part, the Negro would not have been averse to returning to the fold, could the thing be accomplished without danger of reprisal on the part of Skipper Sims and Ward. But he knew the men so well that he feared to trust them, even should they seemingly acquiesce to any such proposal. On the other hand, he reasoned, it would be as much to their advantage to have the deserters return to them as it would the deserters themselves. For when they heard the story told by Red Sanders and Wizen of the murder of the others of the party, they, too, would realize the necessity for maintaining the strength of the little company to its fullest.
"I don't see that we're going to gain nothing by fighting them," said Wizen. "There ain't nothing in it any more nohow for nobody since the girl's gone. Let's chuck it and see what terms we can make with Squint Eye."
"Well," grumbled the Negro, "I can't fight 'em alone. What you doing there, Bony?"
During the conversation, Bony Sawyer had been busy with a stick and a piece of rag, and now, as he turned toward his companions once more, they saw that he had rigged a white flag of surrender. None interfered as he raised it above the edge of the breastwork. Immediately there was a hail from below. It was Ward's voice.
"Surrendering, eh? Coming to your senses, are you?" he shouted.
Devine, feeling that immediate danger from bullets was past, raised his head above the edge of the earthwork.
"We have something to communicate, Mr. Ward," he called.
"Spit it out, then. I'm a-listening," called back the mate.
"Miss Harding, Mr. Terrier, Byrne, Miller, and Swenson have been captured and killed by native headhunters," said Devine.
Ward's eyes went wide, and he blew out his cheeks in surprise. And then his face went black with an angry scowl.
"But you see what you done now, you blithering fools, you," he cried, "with your funny business. You gone and killed the goose what laid the golden eggs. You thought you'd get it all, didn't you? And now nobody won't get nothing unless it is the halter. Nice lot of numbskulls you be, and whimpering round now expecting of us to take you back. Well, I reckon not. Not on your measly lives."
And with that, he raised his revolver to fire again at Devine. The society man toppled over backward into the pit behind the breastwork before Ward had a chance to pull the trigger.
"Hold on there, mate," cried Bony Sawyer. "There ain't no call now for getting excited. Wait till you hear all we got to say. You can't blame us poor sailormen. It was this here fool dude and that scoundrel Terrier that put us up to it.
They told us that you and Skipper Sims was a-fixin' to double-cross us all and leave us here to starve on this godforsaken island. Terrier said that he was with you when you planned it, that you wanted to get rid of as many of us as you could so that you'd have more of the ransom to divide. So all we done was in self-defense, as it were. Now, why not let bygones be bygones, and all of us join forces again these murdering heathen? There won't be any too many of us at best. Red and Wizen seen more'n 2,000 of the man-eating devils. They're a-creeping up on us from behind right this minute, and you can lay to that. And chances are that they got some special kind of route into that there cove, and maybe they're a-watching of you right now.
Ward turned an apprehensive glance to either side. There was logic in Boney's proposal. They couldn't spare a man now. Later, he could punish the offenders at his leisure when he didn't need them any further.
Will you square on the book to do your duty by Skipper Sims and me if we take you back?
Asked Ward.
Well, you bet,
answered Boney Sawyer. The others nodded their heads, and Devine sprang up and started down toward Ward.
Hold on, you, commanded the mate. This here arrangement don't include you. It's just between Skipper Sims and his sailors. You're a rank outsider, and you butts in and starts a mutiny. If you come back, you gotta stand trial for that, see?
You better duck, mister, advised Red Sanders. Elang, you sure?
Devine went white. To face trial before two such men as Sims and Ward meant death. Of that, he was positive. To flee into the forest meant death, almost equally certain, and much more horrible. The man went to his knees, lifting supplicating hands to the mate.
For God's sake, Mr. Ward, he cried, be merciful. I was led into this by Terrier. He lied to me just as he did to the men. You can't kill me. It would be murder. They'd hang you for it.
We'll hang for this muss you got us into anyway if we're ever caught, growled the mate. If you hadn't carried the girl off to be murdered, we might have had enough ransom money to have got clear some way. But now you've gone and cooked the whole goose for the lot of us.
You can collect ransom on me, cried Devine, clutching at a straw. I'll pay 100,000 myself the day you set me down in a civilized port, safe and free.
Ward laughed in his face.
Yeah, you ain't got a cent, you four-flusher, he cried. Clinker put us next to that long before we sailed from Frisco.
Clinker lies, cried Devine. He doesn't know anything about it. I'm rich.
What's the use of chewing the rag about all this?
Cried Blanco, seeing where he might square himself with Ward and Sims easily.
Do you take back all us sailormen, Mr. Ward, and promise not to punish none of us, if we swear to stick by y'all in the future?
Yes,
replied the mate. Blanco took a step toward Devine.
Then you come along too as prisoner, white man.
And the burly black grasped Devine by the scruff of the neck and forced him before him down the steep trail toward the cove. And so the mutineers returned to the command of Skipper Sims, and L. Cortright Devine went with them as a prisoner, charged with a crime the punishment for which has been death since men sailed the seas.